Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the pleasure of interviewing Robert Rogers. Robert Dale Rogers has been an herbalist for over 45 years and is a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild. He has a bachelor's in science from the University of Alberta, where he is presently an assistant clinical professor in family medicine. He is an adjunct professor at York University, and he presently teaches plant medicine, including plant and mushroom medicine, aromatherapy, and flower essences in the Earth Spirit Medicine faculty at Northern Star College in Edmonton, Alberta. Robert is the past chair of the Alberta Natural Health Agricultural Network and the Community Health Council of Capital Health. He is a fellow on the International College of Nutrition, a past chair of the Medicinal Mushroom Committee of the North American Mycological Association, and previously served on the editorial boards of the International Journal of Medicinal Mushrooms. He is the author of an astounding 56 books on the medicinal plants and fungi of the boreal forest, including my personal favorite tome on medicinal fungi, The Fungal Pharmacy: The Complete Guide to Medicinal Mushrooms and Lichens of North America. His extensively mind-blowing body of work also includes notable titles from 2015 to present that include A Cree Healer and His Medicine Bundle, Mushroom Essences, The Vibrational Healing from the Kingdom Fungi, Herbal Allies, My Journey with Plant Medicine, and Medicinal Mushrooms of Western North America. Now, that would all be a lot to cover, but today we're going to be focusing on his most recent work, Medicinal Mushrooms, The Human Clinical Trials, that was published in May 2020. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure to meet you.
Well, likewise, I am a huge fan. You have been massively influential in my own relationship with mushrooms and fungi, especially when it comes to medicinal mushrooms. So I am really excited to talk with you about everything medicinal from a measured and balanced perspective.
Sounds like it'll be fun.
There's a lot to get into, so I don't want to take too long. You know, you have a pretty extensive background that people can go look up, and we'll post links to your website and everything like that. But I guess, what were a couple of the key synchronicities or a couple of the key events that set you down the path of herbalism and studying medicinal mushrooms that you're on today?
Well, in brief, I would say I was a very sick child. I had an uncle came back from the Korean War. I contracted tuberculosis and had my own health challenges. And I found myself, so this is at 6 years old, taking flowers from our garden and neighbors and putting them in a bowl of water. And I didn't even know it. I was making flower essences for myself at that age. And
wow.
And then as I started to overcome some of my health challenges, I just felt natural that I took a bachelor degree in botany. I was going to be a medical doctor, and I just knew that that would be a path that just would be fraught with difficulties, on so many levels. So I finished a botany degree, hitchhiked around South America for a year, and then I ended up north and a group of friends who sort of a hippie commune-y thing in northern Alberta, even further north than I live now. And I didn't know any of the plants that were growing. Here's a botanist not knowing any plants that were growing in the area. And I was fortunate enough to have two indigenous healers. One, Russell Willier, who of course I wrote about in A Cree Healer and His Medicine Bundle, on one side of me, and then a remarkable female indigenous healer, Rose Ogier, on the other. And so I started learning about the plants and of the area. But there were no books in the libraries. There was two books in the library on herbs, and they were both from England. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, this is ridiculous. And I just started to collect knowledge, information, and started to put that aside. And then I, much later in life, I did an 18-year clinical practice where I saw people with health issues on a regular basis for a number of years. And then I wanted to do some writing. I wanted to get out some of the things I'd been doing. And that's when I began to finally put to print some of the things that I always wanted to get out. And, you know, my life was basically for the first 20, well, except for about 26 years ago, I was really obsessed with plants. And then I realized I ran out of plants. We only have around 1,200 herbaceous genera in my part of the world. I'm pretty far north. And then so I started looking around, and I looked at the ferns and the lichens. I know nothing much about mushrooms. Right. And so I started investigating those. And then that whole world opened up. And so the last quarter of a century, I've been kind of obsessed, like many people, with mushrooms and their health benefits and taking pictures of them and just enjoying taking people on walks and looking at them and just all about them.
Yeah, it's almost like this amazing bonus because they are so beautiful and there's something so satisfying about finding them out in the wild. And it's almost this incredible bonus that they also happen to be extremely potent medicinals in terms of the compounds they contain. What's not to love? Something that I'm always taking away from your work, especially fungal pharmacy, is how intimate a relationship different indigenous cultures and different ancient cultures have had with medicinal mushrooms. So just to set the table before we get to some of the basics, the nuts and bolts of what medicinal mushrooms are and what they do, can you talk a little bit about the history of how widespread their use has been in different parts of the world?
Well, of course, we all know that they have been used for thousands of years in Asia. Japan, Korea, and China have been using them, learning how to cultivate them for millennium. But also around the world, I always found it interesting the use of phlyagaric in areas like Kamchatka Peninsula, Russia, also in the Great Lakes of North America for entheogenic. The Mesoamericans, of course, with the psilocybin out of Mexico and further south, that was all suppressed, but that had been going on for thousands of years as well. And so we have a plethora of information about the ethnomycology, but sad to say, not really that extensive in North America per se. I was always kind of disappointed when I started to research a little bit. There's a little on the Pacific Northwest, but by and large, US and Canada, not a lot. That doesn't mean that those mushrooms don't grow in those regions and can be utilized, that's for sure.
This idea of medicinal mushrooms as being treatment for potential ailments, potential conditions, but really we're tapping into quite an ancient lineage that has spanned the globe. So we're just getting up to speed on this knowledge of medicinal mushrooms. So while people tend to think of this as new, this kind of shroom boom, it's like, well, we're kind of just catching up with where a lot of other civilizations have gone before. Just to get into, because you're so knowledgeable about medicinal mushrooms, anyone who's read your books knows they're dense with information, specific compounds. They require, luckily you have, they require a glossary for me to understand some of the chemicals and the compounds and the medical terminology. But what are some of the basics of the structure? I mean, some of this applies to all mushrooms, but the structure of medicinal mushrooms, some of the key compounds, your newest book does a great job of outlining all of them. But what are a couple key ones we can highlight, maybe starting with beta-glucans?
Well, beta-glucans are the water-soluble polysaccharide branched sugars that are very distinct in their nature. If you research a little bit, there often will be people say, well, yeast, which is also of the fungi family, of course, but kingdom, but they are a slightly different branched and molecular weight beta-glucan as well. So there's that what they call a triple helix. And that particular branched structure is very responsible for the physiological benefits of beta-glucans. They're usually the 1,3,1,6. There are some exceptions. And in my latest book, I differentiate for different mushrooms how that may be part of the issue of why they work differently for some people in different conditions. But there also are a lot of 1,4-branched beta-glucans. And these are linear polysaccharides that are very similar, but they don't have the same triple helix kind of a structure, more like a snowflake. And, you know, they're in cereals, like you can oatmeal or cellulose. Those are all 1,4 beta-glucans. Mm. And that's basically what you get when you get a straight myceliated grain, whether it's rice or wheat or oats or whatever. Yes, the mushroom is consuming those particular grains to a particular point of exhausting their food supply, but that is not exactly the same as fruiting bodies, which are the sexual reproductive part of the mushroom. And so they are different. That is to say, myceliated grain, mycelium, and fruiting bodies, they all have benefits, but they're all different. They are completely different. And one of the things I'm trying to get out to the public is that when you're purchasing medicinal mushroom products, make sure you're getting what you're asking for.
That term, beta-glucans, is used so much, you know, as these really beneficial, potent polysaccharide compounds that are kind of the superstars of medicinal mushrooms, as they're called. So it was really interesting for me to read your book and realize there is differentiation even among beta-glucans. What is the difference between that more flat structure and that triple helix structure? And is one better than the other, or do they just function differently in the body?
They do function somewhat differently. I mean, there are some 1,4 beta-glucan activities. There's a couple of products where shiitake enzymes have been put into grains, and they have created a type of a 1,4 structure that seem to be complementary, but they're not exactly the same as medicinal mushrooms. It's a different product, not bad-mouthing it at all. It has some good clinical trials around it, but basically what you want with beta-glucan is something that's going to bind to some of the I would call the Dectin 1 and toll-like receptors. And I don't want to get complicated into the immune system, because that could take us down a rabbit hole. But basically, when you take these, they end up or broken down, transported to the parts of your lymphatic system, like your spleen and your bone marrow, where you're actually going to create all of these white blood cells that include things like natural killer cells and T cells and beta cells and all of these kinds of compounds that both stimulate our innate and our adaptive immune systems. And so beta-glucans are really, really an important part. Now, they are water soluble. Because they're water soluble, you need to basically do a decoction, a low temperature boil. Generally speaking, anything over 70 degrees Celsius, anything higher than that really tends to destroy some of these valuable beta-glucans in things like turkey tail, for example. So, and hericium, the lion's mane. So you need to be careful about the temperature. Companies that do this professionally, commercially, they're aware of temperature gradation. You don't want to destroy the beta-glucans, but you want to derive as many of them as you can from the fungal material.
That makes a lot of sense, and I like that imagery you just put together in my head of beta-glucans essentially being these building blocks of white blood cells and things that directly participate in the immune system. And if I'm understanding that right, that makes it a little more tangible when you say, oh, they boost your immune system. That makes more sense to think, oh, well, they're giving you these special building blocks that enable you to build NK cells, T cells, different things that physically make up and stimulate and enhance your immune system.
And the other side is true. And I think this is important to mention, that very often medicinal mushrooms can be extremely beneficial in autoimmune conditions where you have a ramped up immune system that is running amok, so to speak, and destroying your own tissue. In that particular case, medicinal mushrooms, because they have the ability to be pro or anti-inflammatory through many of these different interleukins, which I have in a glossary in the back of the book that talks about which ones are pro and which ones are anti-inflammatory. They modulate the immune system. That is, when there's a need for A boosting, they can do that. When there's a need to damp down this overreactivity, they also do that. And so really, they're the only thing in the world that I know of, and then from the natural world, that actually do both. I mean, you know, interferon is a drug that is often used to boost the immune system with a lot of problems, and also cortisone, which will suppress inflammation in the body, is very dangerous. It lowers your immune system. It destroys bone tissue. So medicinal mushrooms, they modulate the immune system and they reduce inflammation in your body. I mean, that's amazing.
That's one of the things about medicinal mushrooms that really blows me away the most, is that idea of adaptogens and this idea you're explaining of immune modulating. The fact they never give you too much of something, and they're helping your body, whether it be your immune system, they're helping it achieve homeostasis, which to me in a medicine would seem to be the absolute pinnacle of a medicine, is to help your body better achieve homeostasis. And I think this is really important, that breakdown, because this is such a highly advertised or talked about compound in the realm of medicinal mushrooms. I think it's really important for people as consumers to know the basics of this and how it works to better inform themselves.
Absolutely. You know, when it comes to the majority of the medicinal mushroom fruiting bodies, there are both water-soluble and alcohol-soluble compounds. And I think the idea of a dual extraction where you get water-soluble extracts out, the alcohol-soluble, and combine them probably gives you some of the better products.
One of those alcohol-soluble compounds is triterpenes, and it's something that I don't hear a ton about in the conversation of medicinal mushrooms. So what are triterpenes and what are they doing for the body? How are they beneficial?
Well, they are extremely beneficial. I mean, I think they've identified over 300 in Ganoderma species alone. Basically, what the most important one is ganoderic acid. It's one of the triterpenes out of the fruiting bodies. And basically what they do is they're a major contributor to a process called apoptosis. And what that means is that self-programmed death. To kind of visualize it in your mind, think of it this way. There are a number of different gateways associated with your immune system, sort of like guards around a castle. Let's think of it that way. One of the more important ones is something called P53. By the way, there's a whole book on that subject, P53. This one woman wrote an incredibly great book. You would read 10 pages at night and fall asleep, but really, really makes you really understand the process. But there's a number, P23, P21. So these are all eccentries. And aberrant cells, not necessarily just cancerous, but ones that are really, they're kind of lagging, they're a little sickly, they're misshaped or whatever. They come in touch with these gateways of the immune system, and the immune system will go, yeah, you're pretty good, keep going. This vigilance is going on all the time. But when a aberrant cell comes up to, say, particularly P53, and if you keep that particular gateway healthy, you will be continuing on a daily basis ridding your body of cancer cells, which we have on a daily basis. But when that cell is detected by the immune system, right, it then is forced to do what is known as apoptosis. It kills itself, and then the body takes whatever molecules of information it can use from that cell and reuses it in the body to continue growth. That's why you want to keep an immune system healthy, to keep that optimal vigilance all the time. And so some of the triterpenes like ganoderic acid are very, very useful for triggering the immune system to be vigilant in that manner.
Wow. So they're really strengthening that process that's going on all the time of scanning, identifying, recycling abhorrent cells. Really, that's at the heart of the immune system. So those are only extracted through alcohol decoction.
Yes, the alcohol gives you that added benefit. And that's why if you look back in the literature for example, in the traditional Chinese medicine model, they would often use Lingji, as they would say, or in Japan, the Reishi. They would make wine tonics because they understood that water soluble, really important, but some alcohol to bring the more bitter triterpenes out gave you a better product.
You just hinted at it with that dual extraction process, but have you found one method of processing medicinal mushrooms to be superior? From what we're talking about, it would seem obvious to say, yeah, well, you want the water and the alcohol combined. Is that the best way? I've heard of triple extraction. From your experience, what is the best method of processing any kind of medicinal mushroom or mycelium to get the maximal benefit?
The processing of mycelium is different, but I can speak now about the fruiting body. The triple extraction often suggests that they do initial cold water extraction, which would be before any heat to somehow preserve the enzymes. I mean, medicinal mushrooms contain enzymes like that help break down, of course. That's how mushrooms feed themselves, is basically producing enzymes.
Right.
But I'm not sure that there's really a lot of advantage to that. I would get sort of a blowback on this for some people, but if you really have a digestive system that requires enzyme support, just go to a qualified practitioner and get on some good plant enzymes that are going to give your pancreas that break you need and digest your food properly. That's a good idea. The amount of enzymes that would be in a cold extraction would be pretty minimal.
Well, that's interesting. So that triple extraction includes withdrawing enzymes that are for digestive processes. That's not something I immediately associate with all medicinal mushrooms. And are there any other substances that we should really know about that also come with that alcohol process?
There are other compounds in there. I mean, some of them, like vitamin D, of course, is fat soluble and so alcohol soluble. And mushrooms do contain varying degrees of vitamin D, but mostly have to be enhanced through the exposure to sunlight or UV to additionally give additional benefit to the vitamin D. And I think that if you're eating mushrooms on a regular basis, which I tend to do, you know, I have my favorites and usually try to consume a couple of times a week and by cooking mushrooms. And by the way, make sure that you do cook your mushrooms. There's a lot of people who still are under the misconception that, you know, the garrigus, the button mushrooms, are perfectly safe to eat raw and put in your spinach salad. And I would suggest that although there are compounds that are cumulative toxins in the garrig mushrooms, that you really benefit more from the cooking because you actually liberate all of these other compounds, including the beta-glucans. That's my opinion anyways. But yeah, there's other compounds in there. There's really powerful antioxidants in medicinal mushrooms. And, you know, ergothionein is very much like a precursor to glutathione, which is an incredibly important antioxidant. So important that our body spends actually a fully 7% of the energy we create every day to make this tri-amino acid glutathione to detoxify, to help protect our liver from toxins and to help dissipate toxins through our liver kidney system. So, and that's in every mushroom. Those are ergothionins are in every mushroom and very, very useful. As I mentioned, vitamin D, it can be enhanced. And vitamin D from mushrooms are equally biochemically available to the bloodstream as the seven-step sheep lanolin vitamin D3 that most people are familiar with. So, yeah, so you're getting that benefit. You're getting some statins. You're getting a very interesting sugar, I find, in medicinal mushrooms called trehalose. And then reducing disaccharide that isn't found in animals, it's not found in people. It's present in all mushroom fruiting bodies, and it's also in the mycelium. it does degrade to a degree to glucose in your body, but not totally. And trehalose has been found to be very useful for some of the neuro conditions, such as Parkinson's and Huntington's disease and things of that nature. And so I think that's a really important sugar that is also found in medicinal mushrooms in general.
That's really intriguing, because I saw that sugar and I had never even heard of that. So that's one that could be responsible for useful in treating neurological conditions. And I was also struck by the ergothionine. You just explained the importance, the tremendous importance of glutathione. And ergothionine, if I'm remembering correctly, is not found in plants or animals. So mushrooms may be one of the only sources where you can get a good amount of that precursor to the all-important glutathione.
Yeah, in fact, it's more stable than glutathione. There's a lot of products on the market that say they're quick-acting glutathione or stable or whatever. Glutathione is not very stable at all as a molecule, but ergothionine is definitely stable. Yeah, and the sugars like the trehalose, really potent stabilizer protein, particularly when there's any associated mutant proteins in the brain. I mean, who knows what it could be? We don't know enough yet, but we do know that it's really important sugar. And it also, and coenzyme 9 is a precursor of coenzyme 10, and it's rich in medicinal mushrooms as well. So there's lots of good enzymes and different things in medicinal mushrooms that we could talk about for a long time, but yeah.
Well, and it sounds like you get some of the benefits of all these compounds just from eating them. So just eating more mushrooms and medicinal mushrooms like shiitake, but some of these compounds, it sounds like, are even in the agaricus family some of the more traditional. So just eating them can be beneficial.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the button mushrooms. I mean, I like finding the ones that are wild, of course, but I don't mind having a nice portobello burger once in a while. I quite enjoy that. And so, yeah, a lot of the agaricus have some great things to help with our overall health.
So the medicinal doesn't have to be in a tincture bottle or a powder. It can just be eating the fruit body a little bit more to get some of these great compounds. Now, I want to go into the minefield a little bit of mycelium versus fruit body for their medicinal compounds. The reason I bring this up is I was struck in reading the clinical research and the clinical trials about how much of the trials are centered around myceliated cereals, the mycelium of the given medicinal mushroom growing on a cereal product like oats or rice, and how much that is used in the clinical research and still shows positive effects. I've heard opinions both ways, but as someone who is so much more well-versed in medicinal mushrooms than myself, I would love to hear your opinion on if there is a superiority that we can find between the two, if they're just different, or what kind of the final tally is between myceliated grain products and fruit body products.
That's a great question, and I'll probably upset everybody when I talk about this. But in fact, a few years ago, I wrote an article for, are you familiar with Fungi Magazine?
Of course, Britt Bunyard's magazine. It's fantastic.
Yeah, his magazine, yeah. I wrote an article of fruiting body versus mycelium, and I got feedback from both the people who produce myceliated grain and people who do fruiting body extracts.
Uh-oh.
And both of them gave me their opinion that I was unfair to them. So I figure I must have hit a happy medium there somewhere. It's like, the reality is that fruiting bodies traditionally were all that ever were used, of course. Who would eat mycelium, right? But when it's grown on grain and it's done in a particular manner, it is extremely beneficial, but it is the process by which that myceliated grain is then transformed and then extracted that makes it beneficial. And I'm going to use the example of Trimedes, the turkey tail, as one example. I mean, both in China and in Japan, there are two different protein polysaccharide products that are produced, and they're done in slightly different ways, but they generally involve a fermentation process as well, not just straight myceliated grain. So these fermented mycelium, and then they're extracted. One of them is extracted with hot water, with ammonium sulfate. That's the classic PSK or Creston out of Japan. And then the PCP is very similar, but it contains slightly different sugars. And it's derived at the end with an ethanol, alcohol, ethanol precipitation. It's creating a different product, and both have undergone dozens and dozens of human double-blind placebo-controlled trials showing efficacy with or without chemotherapy and radiation to help people live healthier, quality of life, longer lives. So there's no question that these are great products. Some companies sell turkey-tailed fruiting bodies that are hot water and ethanol extracts, and they suggest that they're very similar to these fermented mycelium products. And I really believe if they're properly done with regards to quality, I believe that they would retain many of the same medicinal properties as the products out of Japan and China.
So when we're thinking myceliated products, there's that process of fermentation that becomes all important. Without blowing me away with too much of the scientific terminology, I'll try to keep up. But what is it about fermentation that transforms this myceliated grain into something more? Just a little bit about what is happening in that process.
I wish I knew. To be honest with you, let's think about it. Those listeners who are familiar with fermentation, maybe some people are familiar with the taking of cabbage and then doing a fermentation, and you end up with sauerkraut or kimchi or whatever, right? And you end up with actually, you know, cabbage is healthy, good. It contains compounds that are interesting. When you ferment those foods, you get a different benefit. And so fermentation can have a very great influence on providing perhaps molecules that are of a different nature. We don't know. I mean, for sure they're different. And in fact, this whole thing is going back, I may be going sideways a bit here, but shaga is undergoing, you know, a little bit of a crazy phase in North America where people are substituting their coffee beverage during the day in the morning, and they're drinking shaga all the time.
Right.
And there are some inherent problems with that. I mean, there are kidney stone issues. There's kidney failure and death that's been recorded. So that's not good. But shaga traditionally, the recipes both from Russia and a Cree healer in northern Saskatchewan who gave me a recipe, they would take this shaga and they would decoct it, and then they would set it over to the edge of their wood stove, cold climates, right? And under that just barely warm condition in the pot, they would ferment for 36 to 48 hours, and they would create a different product than you get just from decoction. And so I'd love somebody, a company who would be interested to take and do the process of fermenting for different periods of time, different ratios, different temperatures, find out what molecules are developed from those particular processes. And we may actually end up with an even more superior product than the one that is now just being used as a recreational beverage.
That alchemical process of fermentation seems to be more and more entering the future of food and the future of drinks. We keep hearing about fermentation, and it is a mysterious process by which microorganisms are going to work, transforming things into something else. And I am surprised, but then not surprised, to hear that fermentation may be a key element in deriving maximal benefit from certain medicinal mushroom compounds. And I really appreciate you bringing this topic up, because it's something I had just not heard before. But again, I'm not surprised. It makes a lot of sense when you think of the fermentation process and all we're discovering about how it nutritionally enhances different foods and different beverages. So maybe part of the future of medicinal mushroom products lies in further explorations in fermentation as well.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And I'm excited to work with, I basically turned down every mushroom company that's ever approached me to be included in their team, so to speak, because I want to have an independence to be able to say what's true for me rather than always have the, oh, you're with our company kind of attachment. But the reality is that, for example, lion's mane, Horacium, there are compounds in both the fruiting body and in the mycelium that both show great efficacy for brain neuron growth factor. And wouldn't an ideal product be extracting from both of those the maximum amount of this really important identified compounds that are, they're all water soluble, that you could then actually create a superior product rather than have this controversy about, oh, it's the fruiting body or, oh, it's the mycelium. I think the best product for Horacium is probably has both.
Wow. Of course, sounds like the more balanced perspective. I think that there would be different compounds in both, but obviously in the way I framed the question, I'm very used to the dichotomy, the either or, and usually the answer is some combination of both. So I love that idea. You know, we've talked about chaga, we talked about lion's mane, and there's kind of this big six medicinal mushrooms that I tend to think of that are really prominent: reishi, cordyceps, chaga, shiitake, lion's mane, turkey tail. But are there any that you've come across that you think show a lot of promise as a medicinal mushroom that just aren't widely available yet? Maybe we haven't fully explored everything, but there's really some promising research. Maybe just one or two that are kind of out of that traditional milieu that you see a lot of promise in as a medicinal mushroom.
Well, I think there's lots. I mean, for example, cordyceps was always out of reach for most people due to the cost. It got up to like $50,000 a kilo at some point.
Wow.
For the wild crafted out of Tibet. And but Cordyceps militaris, which is available now, still a lot of it produced out of China organically, but there are companies in North America now that are producing the fruiting bodies of Cordyceps militaris, which really doesn't need a host insect. And so I think that's going to be definitely a big one in the future. The two others I think that have great promise that really haven't been explored to a great degree in North America, one is the wolf aporia. The aporia is an underground tuber type of mushroom. There's around 70 of them on the Pacific Northwest. They cultivate these in China, and they're used, I would say, 25 to 30% of all traditional Chinese medicine formulas contain aporia mushroom in them. And it's not really that easily available in North America, or not. You can, if you go to a traditional Chinese herbalist, of course you can buy it, but it's not to the same degree as the big six, like you mentioned, right?
Right.
And then the other one that really I think is coming, and this is going to be a myceliated product, is a very interesting mushroom out of Taiwan called Antrodia. Antrodia is a really bright orange mushroom that grows on really big trees. In fact, when they go after the fruiting body, which is getting rare and extinct almost, they show pictures of people climbing into the interior of these trees with mining lamps on their heads and, you know, ropes to get in there to get these fruiting bodies. But the mycelium cultivation of this is just in its infancy in North America. And I'm sure it's going to grow because some of the benefits of this particular cultured mycelium are quite remarkable. And I think it could be part of the next wave.
And if I'm remembering correctly, that's the mushroom that even has the presence of cordycepin.
Yeah, that shocked me. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I couldn't believe it. And I had to research it, double down on it to make sure that I wasn't putting out something that was bogus.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But they did do this study and they found both cordycepin and the adenosine, which is a very closely related compound, were found in this particular mycelium. I was pleasantly surprised. Now, that was in a mango sawdust mycelium, which, you know, we don't really have as much access to in North America, but this particular mushroom will grow in mycelium associated with conifer trees, sorghum, you know, barley. So I think it can be grown very easily in North America, and I think you're going to see a wave of it coming. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, it sounded like, just from reading the book, that fermentation, again, of that myceliated product, whether it's fermented cereals or maybe some kind of fermented liquid culture broth or something, would be kind of at the center of making this widely available.
Exactly. I think as interest grows in medicinal mushrooms, and they are, I mean, the market is exploding.
Yeah.
There's going to be a plethora of functional food nutraceuticals out in the on the market. Oh, you can probably hear my little Norwegian cat.
I can. That is the most adorable meow I've ever heard.
Oh, well, he can be a little annoying too. But yeah, he's cute as a button, that's for sure. Yeah, he's enjoying himself. Anyway, so I think that those are a couple of the mushrooms that I think are going to find their place into the medicinal mushroom, I would say the big 10.
Yeah, so some new ones coming into the fold as we keep learning more and more. And of course, there's so many more beyond that, even some that we don't always think of as medicinal, that are showing promise in your book. And the book is hugely informative. I think you cover a couple dozen of kind of the biggest, probably with the most research behind them, in this book, Medicinal Mushrooms, The Human Clinical Trials. This is your most recent book, and it seems like you're trying to maybe offer a response to people who have given feedback on the whole medicinal mushroom issue. But why don't you speak to that, the impetus for writing the book and really the purpose of it and what you're hoping to communicate with it?
Yeah, well, thank you for letting me share this. The reason I really wanted to write this is that whenever I would give talks around North America or in Europe, I would often be approached after the talk and people would say, yeah, but are they medicinal? Like, have they undergone double blind, you know, placebo control, randomized trials? Mm-hmm. And I said, of course they have. And they go, well, we can't find them. And I said, well, it depends what journals you read. And so mostly I wrote it basically to inform MDs and particularly to help to educate oncologists who now advise very often their clients who are undergoing chemo or radiation to take no supplements while they're undergoing cancer treatment. Mm. And this is absolutely wrong. Many of the trials that have been done were done as adjuncts with medicinal mushrooms while undergoing treatment to prevent the immune system from going down to a level of white blood cell count, for example, to the point where they had to discontinue their treatment. What good does that do anyone? That's part of the issue. That's part of why I wrote it. I wrote it for lay people, of course, and I wrote it for people interested in the subject. But it was also a response to the idea that there are no double-blind placebo-controlled trials. That's so ridiculous. Now, having said that, because I have a position in family medicine, when The Fungal Pharmacy first came out, that was the only book published by a member of the faculty at that point. And so the chair felt obliged to give a little wine and cheese party, and it was all good. And yay, Robert, that was nice. And so afterward, I was feeling pretty good about it. And then just as I'm leaving the room afterwards, one of my colleagues saddles up beside me, not a good friend, but just a colleague. And he goes, He says, well, Robert, he says, that was good. He says, but you know, that's not really a medicinal book. And I didn't know whether to punch him in the nose or to laugh. I wasn't sure, like, how to take it, like what he meant.
Right.
I mean, 1,743 citations, I know, because I had to go through every one of them. Oh, and so it is a medicinal mushroom book, of course. So you can imagine a few years later when I put out a book called Mushroom Essences, which are a vibrational method using mushrooms. Well, that really flipped their wig. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure there's many of the colleagues even want to talk to me about that particular book. It's a little way too far out there.
Robert's a little too woo-woo. He's off the reservation.
Yeah. But, you know, there has been a movement within the Orthodox biomedicine community to move towards what they call evidence-based medicine. And you probably heard this term. And I really don't like it because it basically is suggesting that in 80% of the time, this particular drug will work for 62% of people, with this only 24% having a side effect. And I go, what? So there's a great book out for your listeners might like to check out. It's called Tarnished Gold, The Sickness of Evidence-Based Medicine. And within it, the two authors actually refute all 12 principles upon which evidence-based medicine is being practiced and disprove them all. So having said that, medicinal mushrooms, the human clinical trials, is chock full of double-blind placebo-controlled trials.
There's evidence.
Yeah, because there's evidence, and that's what Orthodox biomedical physicians count on, particularly oncologists who are treating, you know, devastating levels of cancers in our society.
Well, and I think everyone's had a family member or a friend at one point in their life who's had that battle with cancer, and that upon reading the research you put together, that seems to be one of these primary areas where medicinal mushrooms can do the most good, because there are so many studies of all the different species and genera mentioned in the book. They all have some component that looks at it as an adjunctive or as a primary treatment for cancer. So, you know, it's something that's rampant, and this would seem to be an area that we should just pour resources into if the initial evidence offers promise. But then the U.S. has this strange dynamic in medicine where we're beholden to pharmacology and pharmaceutical companies.
I agree. And you don't really have a national strategy for healthcare, which is really showing lately in the numbers I'm seeing frighteningly high on the news every night, that there hasn't been a national initiative to get this under control. And that's a problem when you have a for-profit healthcare system. There's problems.
Yeah, and you know, America is this great land of so many different voices, but sometimes it just feels like a shouting match and no one's on the same page. And I think a lot of the world is seeing us in that light right now with everything going around with the virus. And, you know, this is one area that's not immune, as you're talking about. You know, we can't seem to get on the same page about exactly how we pursue some of these alternative, what's called maybe integrative, different types of medicine that are outside the mainstream of what's been established. And a really big point you bring up in your book is that traditional drugs, I don't want to call them synthetic because a lot of times they are based on natural compounds, but traditional pharmaceuticals as we know them are one of the leading causes of death in the U.S. So to shun medicinal mushrooms as a concept of medicine when the alternative you're standing behind is one of the leading causes of death doesn't seem to be a really solid platform to stand on to me.
No, when taken as directed.
Exactly. We'll take it as directed. That's key.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, people who abuse them, that's there are even higher rates of death. But, you know, I mean, taken as directed, people have these kind of iatrogenic kind of experiences and filling the hospitals. And it's sad because really, I mean, it's all part of the big pattern of make food your medicine and medicine your food. And I really believe that on all levels. The support for the organic production of great foods, which would keep people healthy. Instead, governments, and including Canada is remiss in this too, supporting huge subsidies to grow corn and wheat and soybeans and things that are then fed to animals or made into ethanol or whatever. And it's just crazy. I mean, food is your best source of health and well-being. People have to really start paying attention. This cheap food, eating at McDonald's three times a week, it's got to stop.
Yeah, there's no scenario where we continue down that kind of course and we somehow get better health outcomes. And I think we're seeing that so obviously in the data. And mushrooms feature prominently in kind of this new direction to a more holistic diet, a better path toward wellness that's a little bit more balanced than necessarily still eating the bad foods and then taking a drug to deal with the outcomes that come from that. It's like there's another way, and mushrooms feature prominently. Something in the book, a concept that's very big. Obviously, the book is about the human clinical trials about different medicinal mushrooms. But obviously, there are many trials that aren't double-blind, placebo-controlled. Sometimes they aren't even human trials. And you introduce these two concepts that feature prominently, in vivo and in vitro trials. What do those mean when we say we have an in vivo or in vitro trial to study some aspect of medicinal mushrooms or some compound? What do those terms mean?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, basically, I do kind of give the definition, and I did a glossary in this book, which I
thankfully
was remiss in doing. Yeah, and so basically, in vitro means that it's been tested in a, you know, a test tube or a petri dish where they challenge a particular compound or a cell. For example, one of the ways to suggest that something may be an immune stimulator would be to take splenocytes out of a mouse's spleen, put them in a petri dish, and then put a compound in there and see if the splenocytes start to grow faster or if they die. So that's an in vitro, and they're kind of a very preliminary approach, and you know, you got to start somewhere. But right. I don't really put a lot of faith. In vivo is in lab animals or sometimes in human studies where they actually will take cells, for example, rats and mice are often used, sometimes guinea pigs or sometimes rabbits, where they will actually take and transfer, let's say, a cancer medium into an animal and then give them, in this case, the medicinal mushroom extract and see how their body reacts. Does the tumor shrink? Does the numbers of tumors go down? And so that's more in vivo, and that's another closer step to actually human clinical trials, which is quite different because we don't really react like any of those animals. If they had tested aspirin when it first came out on cats, all the cats would have died and that would have been the end of it. We would have never had aspirin on the market. So there you go.
Right. So those aren't necessarily direct analogs, but like you're saying, they're those introductory steps to see maybe if they warrant more testing or warrant more exploration. Obviously, there's a limited amount of choices of research that can happen at once. So you got to try to pick your path, and those might be useful tools. But when you're reading research, it's not always readily apparent that it might be an in vivo or an in vitro study. So I know that's one of the critiques you address in the book, is that folks dismiss any findings because it's in vivo or in vitro. They dismiss it completely. Do you think that's going too far?
Well, I think it's going too far in the sense that I find in vitro and in vivo studies interesting in where they could lead,
right,
but they're not comparable to a human trial. Having said that, over the past 15 years, there have been nearly 300 drugs have been gone through phase one, phase two, and sometimes phase three human clinical trials for Alzheimer's, and all have failed except one. And the one that did make it doesn't work very well.
Wow.
And so what we're finding is that Alzheimer's is basically a plaquing or a creating of these amyloid, beta amyloid plaques, or these tau little tangles in the brain. We should be perhaps looking at what is creating the brain doing this. And for example, trehalose, one of the sugars, seems to be very effective from preventing those kind of interactions. But a study that really interested me, and why I think we're off track with drug production for Alzheimer's, is that they took some of those plaques that were from the brains of individuals who passed away, and they cut them open. And guess what they found in 70% of those plaques? Just take a guess.
I want to say fluoride. No. you know, some artificial chemical that's in our diet or something, some preservative or?
Yeah, closer than that, a virus. In fact, this herpes simplex 1 virus.
Wow.
Your good old-fashioned cold sore.
Really? The cold sore on your brain?
The virus enters a leaky brain, leaky gut, leaky brain, goes through the blood-brain barrier, and the brain freaks out and encapsulates that virus in and plaques it, like protects it by putting fatty tissue around and going, whoa, we got to stop this. Our brain's on fire. And then that's what creates it. So this idea that you can come up with a drug that's going to prevent plaquing, I don't think that's a good idea. As one researcher said, the idea that plaquing of the brain is the fireman, it's not the fire.
Right. That's actually the system in place, the brain's defense system.
Exactly.
That's really interesting. So by trying to just simply treat that symptom that they're finding, which is a common theme among kind of the pharmaceutical focused model, you're treating the symptom and you may actually be doing something that's more harmful than if you tried to address the cause. And as we're talking about before, about medicinal mushrooms and their compounds, the fact that they make these precursors to important compounds used in the body, those would seem to be such an effective vector if you're going to look at causes. Would it be look at something like mushrooms that provide building blocks for the body to, again, try to maintain homeostasis?
And to go further to the story, if you have a healthy microbiome, which science is starting to finally figure out, that, by the way, beta-glucans help to provide an optimal population of healthy bacteria in the gut. That will help prevent the leaky gut that then prevents compounds that shouldn't be going into the bloodstream and then going and attacking, you know, a leaky brain. And get this, this might shock you out of your mind, that 2 aspirin a week have been found in studies to create leaks in the brain.
Wow, aspirin. So maybe the acetaminophen?
Just aspirin. It doesn't just cause the leaky gut. I mean, aspirin will put little holes in your stomach, right? I mean, we all know that.
Right.
But it also will cause little leaks in the brain. So that's not good. And no. one study on a large number of nurses, like tens of thousands of nurses, they found those who were taking 3 to 5 aspirin a week for a number of years had an 80% greater risk of pancreatic cancer.
So you're essentially opening up the defenses around organs like the brain or like the stomach to invaders, if you will, to viruses, to different ailments to get in there. And I don't know if I want to hear this about aspirin because it's so ubiquitous. How do we save everyone from this?
I know. Well, you have to reduce inflammation in your body. I mean, aspirin is often given or often taken when you create for a headache or an ache or pain or whatever. And inflammation in your body anywhere in any tissue is a bad indicator of future chronic health conditions. And so, yeah, so mushrooms help on all those kind of levels. They're extremely beneficial to keep inflammation down in your body and optimize the immune system.
Absolutely. And just to dive into a couple of the clinical trials, obviously this could be multiple podcasts for all the human clinical trials that are double blind, placebo controlled, often randomized. You do a great level of detail in isolating these individual studies and exactly what they were and what their findings were. One big takeaway for me was a lot of these are done in Asia. I mean, a majority of the studies you're referencing are from Asian journals, I would guess, journals of medicine that you found?
Yes, I think that would be true. I would say 85-90% have been done in Japan or China or Korea. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why biomedicine has really not really looked favorably at medicinal mushrooms, simply because those are not journals they read.
Right, and it's journals that I don't think the layperson would even have access to or know where to find. So that's one thing about your book, is really useful as a reference point for all this other great information that would probably be hard to find otherwise. And just to hit a couple of the big medicinal mushrooms we've already mentioned, just to say, hey, we know they have these great effects, you know, with that placebo-controlled double-blind environment, we're also seeing great effects. And Ganoderma is the one that stands out as probably having the most clinical trials and really what it seems like the most potent effects on a wide range of ailments.
Yeah, it's been probably one of the better studied. I would say when you look at the evidence, it's been really, I think there's been a bit of a misnomer about reishi and Ganoderma lucidum. The use of that term is really faulty on so many levels. But we do have a number of North American Ganodermas that have a number of the same compounds that Ganoderma lucidum, which really is probably a European or perhaps Chinese species based on molecular studies anyways. But the beta-glucan and triterpene compounds in Ganoderma sugae or Oregonense or even my Ganoderma aplanatum, which is the artist conch, which is the only Ganoderma I have in Alberta on this side of the Rockies. Yeah. They all have compounds that are very similar in their activity. It's just that most of the research has been done on what is called Ganoderma lucidum. And some of the studies are pretty impressive. I mean, we're talking about use for urinary tract conditions. We're talking about diabetes, advanced stage cancers, blood pressure, cardiovascular issues, colorectal cancers, you name it. I mean, it's been, the trials have been done. Reishi is one of the great medicines for all kinds of respiratory conditions. Would be one of my go-tos if I needed to support my respiratory system in any way. I would certainly look at some of the Ganoderma products.
Absolutely. And one that stands out just in the frame of what we were talking about with that potential hepatitis on the brain and the plaques forming because the virus has gotten in there. It looks like there was a double-blind, randomized 12-week trial on patients with chronic hepatitis B, and it showed successful activity against the virus.
Absolutely. Some of the medicinal mushrooms have both a direct virucidal and indirect activity against viruses based on the pathways. That is, letting the immune system address the virus by creating the environment where the T cells and then the B cells, which are really important for viral infections to take place. And that's why, unfortunately, some people die in cases of, for example, with COVID. Their immune systems were already suboptimal and they could not create within themselves the protection that would be afforded from a healthy immune system.
That's immediately what my mind jumps to is, could Ganoderma be one of these effective tools to have in this battle that we're in against the COVID-19 virus? Could Ganoderma be effective in the battery of supplements that we can use to take to strengthen ourselves and steel ourselves against it, if you will?
Well, I would say yes and no. There is a proviso here that I think is important for people to understand, is that taking medicinal mushrooms at the moment of coming down with a flu-like symptom probably is quite a less effective way than already having taken mushroom extracts to keep your immune system optimal to begin with.
Right.
And in fact, there are a few mushrooms, for example, cordyceps. Cordyceps should never, ever, ever be taken during an acute flu-like fever. And so people shouldn't be doing that. So I think it's an individual case and it depends on the individuals. And those who have autoimmune conditions, if they wanted to help guard their system so that if they were in contact with COVID, that they would have a better chance of less effects or survival levels, then I would say yes, that medicinal mushrooms could be greatly beneficial, but not in the acute form.
It's preventative in getting your system geared up or prepared to be exposed potentially to environments that have the virus in them.
And there is some speculation that's been tossed around, and I I don't totally buy it, that maitake and turkey tail have been suggested in some publications that they ramp up the immune system too rapidly. And of course, the beginning of inflammation, which is the way only way our body has to fight a virus, is to create temperature, elevate temperature to kill viruses, right? They can't live above a certain temperature in your body. That inflammation destroys tissue, which might be more rapid if you really ramp up too quickly. And I'm not sure about that, but I do think people need to be guarded and pay attention to how their immune system is functioning going into this.
Well, and I appreciate you presenting the realities of supplementing with medicinal mushrooms, that there are things to be wary of. And I was interested to hear that about cordyceps, that if you have flu-like symptoms, not to take cordyceps, but just, you know, in looking at the trials on cordyceps, which I assume would be almost all cordyceps sinensis or CS4, there are some really promising results from the studies of CS4, because I think we associate cordyceps most regularly with athletics and activity, and it boosts your circulatory system in some way. But in reading a couple of the double-blind, again, placebo-controlled studies in the book, there's some definitive evidence there that cordyceps, again, helps with performance, metabolic and ventilatory thresholds, and even that it has effect inhibiting tumor metastasis and modulating the immune system. It's the mycelium of cordyceps that are having these great effects as well.
Yes, I think CS4, which really isn't cordyceps, but it's a kind of an anamorph, but nonetheless, they have had great studies. And I do know there's one company that has been sending large amounts of myceliated cordyceps, the CS4, to I think at least 13 countries in Africa for keeping down the viral load of HIV. So I think there's lots to it. I personally am more of a favor of the Cordyceps militaris fruiting body. I think it is a more potent product, but they both have their place. Yeah, as you can see, I'm not really, I'm not taking sides here with fruiting body versus mycelium. I think they're both.
Right.
But I think people need to know the difference. And then when they go to spend their dollars, what are they getting? What bang are they getting for their buck?
Right. And, you know, I tend to almost always fall on that side of fruiting body is better. And that's why reading through some of these trials, it opened my mind to the idea that the mycelium can have benefits as well. So for me, I'm kind of pushing myself back from the other side, from again, that fruiting body side toward balance, just seeing both elements of the potential medicinal compounds. And just speaking to that idea of it lowering viral load, there was, it looks like, a randomized double-blind study in 2019 that a mycelium extract of cordyceps, again, not to get too much into that territory, but it was given to 39 healthy adults for 4 weeks and showed a 38.8% enhancement of NK cells. So again, those would be those white blood cells. So it just speaks to that idea that they could help with the immune system and help manage viral load.
Definitely. Natural killer cells are good. They come with inflammation and you have to be prepared to do that. And I've been kind of watching the whole thing for a while there in the news. There was news about young children who were suffering some kind of a lasting conditions from COVID, that it was an immune response type of thing. What I would be curious about, and which really isn't talked about a lot, is whenever you take a drug, if you take aspirin or you take Tylenol or, you know, a lot of these particular drugs that really suppress the fever state, what you basically are doing is you're driving the condition deeper into your tissue. Your body needs to actually have a inflammatory condition that's controlled, where your skin breathes and you sweat and you create, you know, a wet fever where you're perspiring. It can't kill you. And so the suppression of minor fever-like states, I don't think it's a good idea. And I haven't seen really any literature about that, but I'd be very curious in the number of the children who have suffered a month later after COVID, these really more serious autoimmune, were they given an aspirin or a Tylenol? Baby aspirin, baby Tylenol. I'd be very curious. It'd be interesting to do the study on that.
Yeah, we don't want to get in the way of our body's natural processes that have developed for tens of thousands of years for a reason. And that's what I'm really taking away from just speaking with you, is the different way we can look at symptoms versus conditions. And I think this is becoming more and more acknowledged, but that idea that symptoms aren't necessarily what you need to go after or attack with your treatment, but it's really looking at underlying what's going on in the body. And then, you know, the symptoms may be part of your body's natural defense system that we don't want to get in the way of. And that's interesting to hear that natural killer cells, NK cells, which I like the name of. I want more NK cells protecting my body, but just that idea that it does come with inflammation. And there's some other symptoms you'd have to look at. And in that case, inflammation is the sign of, you know, an increased response by your immune system and not necessarily something that needs to be pounded down or suppressed.
You know, when I had clinical practice, I'd often have people come in and they said they had chronic illness and conditions. And I'd say, well, when's the last time you had a cold or a flu or whatever? And they go, oh, I haven't had one of those in 20 years. When I heard that, I would get worried. And I would do whatever I could to induce a fever type condition, get them into saunas, get them into whatever it took to elevate and get things moving to in a direction of acute phase, which is painful. Like, nobody likes pain. But moving through that, on the other side of it, is a more normalization of our homeostasis. So, yeah, I really think that a lot of the chronic illness that is suffered in North America today is due to suppression of symptoms earlier on by a plethora of different methods.
Yeah, that's a really good perspective to have. And on this vein of looking at COVID and respiratory conditions, something I was really interested to see was human clinical trials in the book on pleurotus. And there was one study that stood out in 2013, again, double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized study, looking at children only 5 to 8 years old who had more than 5 respiratory infections in 12 months prior to the study. And they were given, one side of the study was given, it sounds like a syrup, an immunoglucan syrup derived from pleurotus ostreatus versus the placebo, just vitamin C. And you know, there was a 17% increased incidence of the kids taking the pleurotus ostreatus derived syrup, 17% higher incidence of not having respiratory infections. And not to then directly extrapolate that to COVID, but it makes you wonder if pleurotus, or maybe there is some medicinal mushroom out there that has a benefit against respiratory infection that maybe is not recognized yet, because that study you pointed out was the first time I had heard of that when it came to oyster mushrooms.
Yeah, I think oysters are a phenomenally important medicinal mushroom on so many levels, so easy to grow. I mean, and there's different varieties of different species, of course, of oysters. Again, it comes down to this, like I just caution people, because you can go into your health food store and if you see capsuled oyster mushroom powder, all they've done is taken oyster mushrooms and just dried them and put it in a capsule. The amount of chitin in there will prevent any benefit at all. There needs to be a process with oysters, just like other mushrooms, in order to create a something that your body can utilize properly. And so in this particular case you're citing, they created a type of a syrup out of the oyster mushrooms with the beta-glucan itself. And so, yeah, there's lots. I mean, we could go on for hours.
I just wanted to give people a flavor of some of the clinical trials and research that we find.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's really quite rigorous and quite detailed. And I think it's a great journey to go on to read about these things. And it gives a lot of information that I don't hear, even in kind of the shroom boom mainstream of promoting medicinal mushrooms. There are some conditions addressed and some things mentioned here that I just hadn't thought of. So again, an amazing coalescing of knowledge that you did. I guess with all this information in mind, my couple examples here of some of the human clinical trials, what do you think the future is of human clinical trial research on medicinal mushrooms? I would hope we're going to see you know, a waterfall of absolutely tons of clinical trials on this. Do you see more of that happening in the Western world, America, Canada, England, those kind of places? Do you see that on the horizon as we get more idea of their benefit and they become more popularized?
I would hope so. I also am a bit of a pragmatist in that I understand that the singular molecular approach that pharmaceutical companies like, meaning that they are able to somehow patent that compound for a set of 15 or 20 years or whatever, that a particular approach will not work with medicinal mushrooms. Mm. So the only way that a company that's going to invest several million dollars and years into clinical trials is that they can somehow protect their proprietary process. Like, for example, PSK in Japan from turkey tail. Yes, it's turkey tail, but they did a specific patented process to protect themselves so they can actually recoup the money they spent on the trials. So I think it's going to take some people with deep pockets, investor, angel investors, things of that nature. I've been trying for 3 years to get just $250,000 to do a lion's mane double-blind placebo with the first 6 months to 1 year trial, and having a great deal of difficulty, ethical boards, all of that all passed, but just coming up with that money. I don't have that money. And so the only way that somebody could actually recoup their investment and contribute to helping medicinal mushrooms further the health of the planet would be for them to have a proprietary product that they can then market later and say, this is the exact product that showed efficacy in this trial, and away we go. And I don't think it has to be pharmaceutical. I just think it has to have protection for the person who invested in the idea.
Right. And it makes you wonder if more and more of these compounds, maybe a fermentation process or some other specific process that creates something that's not just the mushroom fruit body or just the mycelium, but something to transform it, may be actually one of the better paths forward, because there is a monetary side of it that can then lead to investment in the clinical trials. Do you see medicinal mushrooms, you know, assuming that there is some more clinical trials, or maybe even just based on the evidence we already have, do you see medicinal mushrooms entering that biomedical mainstream here in the US and Canada? Obviously, I'm talking more about Western societies here. Do you see that entering the biomedical mainstream? So we've talked about, you know, the holistic path is gaining some ground. People are seeing the limitations of a purely pharmaceutical treat the symptom approach. Do you see that happening, medicinal mushrooms entering mainstream biomedical medicine?
My wife says I'm always optimistic about, you know, the time frame with these things, but I would say I'm 70 years old right now. I would say I would hope within my lifetime that we'll see that happen. And I am hopeful that there will be a movement towards creating products that really have this efficacy that can definitely change the health and well-being of the people on this planet. And I do believe medicinal mushrooms have that ability. The studies will get done. I think that it's going to take deep pockets, like I mentioned, and there are companies out there that have made money from isolates of medicinal mushrooms that may start looking at the more holistic picture. And that's my hope.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. My one big takeaway from your book was there is such a body of knowledge already that as individuals, we can be proactive in seeing how we can integrate medicinal mushrooms, differentiate between the products out there, and start to take a little more control or a little more responsibility for our own health and integrating medicinal mushrooms into that path.
I agree. Well, let's see it happen. I'm looking forward to the next step. This particular book had to be cut off at a certain date and get out there to the public. Right. But, you know, there are some trials I mentioned in the book that are ongoing, and results are coming out next year. And so I think it's going to be addition, like maybe a couple of years from now, I can put the same book out or re-edit it that includes the newest, latest trials. I'm hoping that someone will step forward in the next few years. I have great hope, actually. Speaking to some people with regards to a Parisium product that's both fruiting body and mycelium, and particular percentages of the active compounds in both, right. As a combined product, that would be enough to give people a little patent protection, enough that they could go ahead, do the trial, and at the end with the product go, here's the product that was associated with this trial. Here you go.
That is one of those mushrooms that has such hope for a lot of debilitating conditions that we see. You know, it's often referenced in conjunction with Alzheimer's. I know in the book there are clinical trials done on mild cognitive impairment that did find some benefit. So yeah, I hope that as well. And that's one of the teasers in the book that I definitely wanted to know more about, was where we were heading with lion's mane, because there's so much promise there.
Yeah, and the other side of lion's mane, of course, is that it has a favorable influence on your microbiome, which would help prevent the leaky gut that creates the problem with, say, viruses like herpes virus entering the brain and creating the inflammatory process that creates the plaque. I think you need both. I think you need to reduce the inflammation, and then you have to give compounds that are able to cross the blood-brain barrier that increase that dendritic neuron growth factor. I think both go together.
Which is fantastic, because they're also one of my favorite ones to eat and to look at. So I'm all in on lion's mane. That's exactly what I wanted to hear about. If you have any right now, what are some of the future plans for you, for your work? And then where can people find you and find the book?
Oh, that's great. Well, you can get the book a full color, which is, I think, prettier. You know, color pictures of mushrooms are always fun. Or you can get a little less expensive black and white on the inside. And you can get that from Amazon. That would be the easiest thing for people in the U.S. to access right now. Just called Medicinal Mushrooms, the Human Clinical Trials. Easy. Just order it. Comes to your door. Right now, I have been running a 3-year college program on medicinal herbs and mushrooms. With distancing, it wouldn't work for classrooms. So I'm trying to figure out a way that I can still offer some education to groups of people. I'm kind of feeling like I'm not sure what's next. I do know one thing I'm doing that I want to complete at some point is I bought a machine a couple of years ago. It's called Music of the Plants. And I've been hooking it up to different mushrooms. And you tune it in, and then you can play back the vibration from the mushrooms, the signature that they're giving to this machine, in about 120 different modalities, i.e. Guitar or piano or violin or whatever. And so I've been collecting those up, and at some point I'd like to take that mushroom music and share it with the world. I also have a film that I've been trying with the last 4 years now to complete. I only need another $20,000 or something to do that. And it's called The Cosmos of Mushrooms. Good filmmaker I'm working with out of Winnipeg. We've gone around and we've interviewed most of the major people involved in medicinal mushrooms around the world. And we just need to finish it up, a little animation and all of that. And I'd like to share that. I do know that fantastic fungi film that came out got, you know, great reviews by people who love mushrooms. And this one is going to be a little different than that, in that it's going to entail experts from many fields in mushrooms who share their story, their journey, their take on this whole area. So I'm hoping that film will come out in the next few years.
Oh, I think everyone listening is hoping, because there can't ever be too many great mushroom movies. And I think you have such a unique body of knowledge on such an important topic right now, and that is really informing consumers about medicinal mushrooms and really what they are and what's best. So I really look forward to that documentary coming out. And the music of the mushroom, you've just elucidated the dream of my partner when she saw that Music of the Plants technology, where you can hook up those diodes or those two biological matter, plants, mushrooms, mycelium, and get sound from it. She just thought that was the best thing ever. So I love that idea.
It's too much fun. It really is. I mean,
you're making music of the mushroom.
My difficulty is because the music that's generated can come out in 120 different forms, putting myself into the space of listening to it from how does a red belted conch express itself.
Yeah.
Like, what instrument would it choose if it could? So it's the most authentic to me.
Right.
And so that's my challenge.
you need to see from the mushroom perspective.
You have to see everything from a mushroom perspective. That is the key to being a good mushroom person, is put yourself in where they're in. Like, why do they do what they do? And then you'll understand a lot more.
From talking to you, I can tell you've done plenty of that seeing from the mushroom perspective at this point. Definitely good advice. I'm going to wrap up with a couple questions I ask all my guests just to get a little more insight. And I think you've been very open and showed us the core essence of who Robert is to some extent. But just to expand on that, and that's a lot to put on these three questions. It's very grand aspirations for them. But what is the mushroom of the moment for you? What's a mushroom you love right now and why?
I would say I'm still interested in exploring the fly agaric, the Amanita muscaria more. Mm. It has compounds in it that are very interesting to me, both internally and externally as well. And so that's the one that's on my mind lately.
Yeah, there were some interesting parts in the book talking about the unique compounds in the Amanita family and even ways they can be packaged inside other cells to kind of deliver their potentially deadly payload to viruses. That was really, really interesting. So I love that.
And cancer cells too.
Yes, cancer cells. I think that's what it was. But yeah, that's really, I mean, we all love looking at them, but to think there's even more to unlock there is fantastic. And then pretty general question, but what has a relationship with fungi given to you, aside from just being able to see from the mushroom's perspective? What has a relationship with fungi given to you in your life?
Well, I think that when I was 22, I had my first experience with psilocybes. Hmm. That definitely opened my eyes to reveal some of the veils of other realities on this planet and allows me to have a little bit more of a broad spectrum of horizontal and lateral experiences and integrating different things rather than kind of doing this solitary, straight down the line kind of approach.
Right. They can definitely stretch our mind and our concepts of what's possible and offer new perspectives that are more than human perspectives, if you will.
Yeah, the recent evidence of some of the psilocybe studies are remarkable. And I believe that Oregon is actually going to have a referendum this November on the decriminalizing or the legalizing of those mushrooms. So that's phenomenal. That's really phenomenal.
Which is no small task, because usually it does require physical collection of some hundreds of thousands of signatures. And I recently saw that as well. So a fantastic job to the team there in putting that together, just that civic effort, especially at a time where we're shut down like this,
to
be able to put that together really shows, among so many other things, really shows the amount of passion that psilocybe inspires and the anecdotal effects that it seems to have on people's lives really are a huge driving force, clearly, to have that effort move forward.
I think between the legalization of cannabis and the movement for with psilocybin studies that and legalization of that, if I was looking where to invest my money, I wouldn't be putting it into pharmaceutical companies.
I think the solutions offered by natural medicines are going to quickly outstrip the imitations.
We can all hope.
We can all hope. That would be the best case scenario. And the final question here, what is the lasting impact that you hope to make with your massive body of work on everything from medicinal mushrooms to mushroom essences to highlighting indigenous traditions with herbs and medicinal mushrooms? What's the impact you hope to have in kind of the greater scheme with that work?
Really haven't really thought of that. I guess the work will stand on its own and those who appreciate the journey, which really, it's not like I chose this path. It chose me and has led to me having just the most wonderful, fulfilling, exuberant life that you could imagine. And that's been its reward in itself. I mean, I get up in the morning. I remember many years ago having a beer with my brother. He's 2 years younger than me. And we were sitting and having a beer, and he looks over at me. He says, "Robert," he says, "you know," he says, "I'm so jealous of you." And I said, "Oh, why?" He says, "You get up in the morning and you know what you want to do, and you're full of joy, and you just can hardly wait, and you're never bored and whatever." And my brother, of course, he's a millionaire. And he said, "I'm really jealous of you." And I said, "Well, you know what? Thank you. I kind of lucked into, I didn't choose this path. When I was after university, I didn't really know what I was going to do. And it just, I was led into the forest. And then I was led into exploring these plants that I had never seen before. And then these mushrooms that were all over. And basically, that's sort of been my life. I've been the better for it. And if other people get inspiration from my work, that's fantastic. That's all a bonus.
When you have that kind of authentic passion and purpose about something that's coming really from the core of your being, and then, you know, you take conscious action upon that, you can't help but to have an impact in the world, a positive impact in the world. So I definitely think you've done that for me and a lot of other people. And I greatly appreciate the huge body of work that you've brought forward, none the least of which this most recent book, which again, I'm kind of obsessed with. I sent you a massive outline on it because I was just tearing through the information. And thank you so much for just doing everything you do. And thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour podcast and sharing that with us. Obviously, we only covered a tiny fraction of your body of work, but it was just a joy, and I learned a lot. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I just share this with people who want to check out some of the publications. My wife is an author as well, and she does very interesting work with dream work and depth psychology with women and things they might interest. So we have a website. You can check out all our work. It's at www.selfhealdistributing, and that's all one word, S-E-L-F-H-E-A-L. distributing.com. And now we are in Canada, so most of our books are better gotten from Amazon, because shipping's crazy from Canada to the US and vice versa. It's just ridiculous. Right. So I invite you to, but you can look up the different titles that we have, and then you can go to Amazon and get next door delivery for free, which is mind-blowing for a Canadian, but you guys have that access, so I would go that way.
A lot of people know that the only true healing comes from within the self, so you guys picked a powerful name, and you're certainly a dynamic duo. I didn't realize that she did dream work and was into kind of in tune with some of the subtler energies, so what a great combination you guys are able to offer to each other.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. We often end up telling yin-yang jokes to each other at the table.
Plenty to look into there. Again, thank you, Roger, and I look forward to future conversations.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.